Welcome. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with an article from AARP The Bulletin under the heading of Your Life, The Song That Changed Me. The right lyric or melody at the right moment can mean so much. These seven people share their stories of music that had a profound impact. We won't be able to do all of them right now, but we'll get to them eventually. The moment. Recovering from surgery. The song. These Are Days. 10,000 Maniacs. Scott Rinder, 59, Louisville, Kentucky. Getting a hip replacement at 29 sucks. When I was 9, I was diagnosed with leg calvopersis disease, so I knew that someday I would need surgery. It's a rare disease with blood flow not going to the hip properly. After the surgery, I woke up at 4 in the morning really depressed. I had all these nightmares from the medications. I put on These Are Days. The lyrics talk about these are the days you'll remember. Never before and never since. I promise. You are blessed and lucky. You are touched by something that will grow and bloom in you. My perspective changed. I knew I was going to be okay. To this day, when I hear that song, those lyrics take me back. It was a good moment to get through. Next, the moment having a daughter. The song, Little Wing. Jimi Hendrix Experience. This is from Jeremy Miller, 52, of Fisherville, Kentucky. During my wife Shelley's pregnancy, I thought, if the baby is a girl, this would be my song for her. The song is sort of mystical, carefree and full of wonder. It's the lyrics. Well, she's walking through the clouds. I related to everything that's sweet and wonderful that life brings. My daughter, Ella Blue, is 13 now. She may know that it's one of my favorite songs, but I never specifically said, this makes me think of you. I wonder what she'll have to say about that. And the next one, the moment is falling into depression. The song, God Has Another Plan, Babby Mason. This is from Unita Chambers, 61, of Macedonia, Ohio. After recovering from a long, rough stretch of being unhoused around 1994, I found myself in another horrible position. I was living in Atlanta, struggling financially, and my relationship fell apart. I already suffered from clinical depression, and all I could do was sit on the edge of my bed and stare out my window and cry. I would shower and sleep, but barely ate. I didn't answer the phone or have company. I was a prisoner of my own mind. One night, this song came on the 24-hour worship channel. The first line said, out of the fire, into the flames of another trial. When you feel that your heart has had all it can take, and there is nothing left to break. It spoke to my spirit, which was processing years of hurt and anger and frustration. By the time the song was over, I had cried so much, I switched from napkins to paper towels to a bed sheet. I then started writing poetry, and later met Babby. She gave me the artist name Neo Solja, which was so empowering. I moved back home to Ohio. I got a job in corporate America and have had success with my artistic endeavors. That song was the turning point. It literally saved me. And let's do one more for now. The moment, coping with death. The song, Humble and Kind, Tim McGraw. This is from Carrie Thompson, 51, Spokane, Washington. In 2016, my only child, Monty Jr., was killed in a car accident at age 17. We did everything together and had just gone camping with family the day before his death. When we had to choose the songs for the funeral, one of them was Humble and Kind, which perfectly described him. In addition to taking high school and college classes simultaneously, Monty had a part-time job and regularly volunteered. He was such a giving kid. He would drop anything for anybody. When he died, it broke me. I didn't leave the house for months. I couldn't work for 2.5 years. But that song would always lift me when I was at my lowest, when I couldn't get up, when I didn't know if I could make it through the day or endure the path. It would suddenly come on, and I would be like, "All right, kid, I've got this." 7 years later, I am much better, but that song still inspires me to persevere through the dark days and make Monty proud. All right, now, also in AARP The Bulletin, let's go back to their cover story about your health. Here's a sidebar article, Women and Menopause and IBS. IBS can plague people of any age, but one recent study found that IBS pain is most severe in postmenopausal women. Lynn Chang, MD, a gastroenterologist at UCLA and co-author of the study, is conducting federally funded research comparing the brain-gut microbiome interactions in premenopausal and postmenopausal women. The research hypothesis, she says, is that the lower estrogen levels, which occur in menopause, as well as during various points in the menstrual cycle, can contribute to greater dysregulation of brain-gut interactions. The research also studying the relationship between low estrogen levels and the gut microbiome, which is not well understood. These relationships could lead to an increase in IBS symptoms in women as they age. Now, going back to why do I have IBS, food sensitivities. As we age, we have less enzymes to break down the types of sugar found in carbohydrates, Limbo explains. A 2020 study of patients with IBS symptoms found that about half had a disaccharidase deficiency. I hope that's right. Ultra-processed foods, which include multiple chemical additives, can exacerbate symptoms, Luo said. What you can do. Your doctor may suggest that you try what's called a low FODMAP diet, F-O-D-M-A-P. This is a diet that, under special supervision, reduces foods that some people find hard to digest, including certain fruits and veggies, dairy, beans, and some grains and nuts. Typically, you follow this elimination diet for 2 to 4 weeks and then gradually add these foods back in under the guidance of your doctor. Luo also recommends patients try a Mediterranean diet with lots of vegetables, fish, and olive oil, and avoid processed foods. Genetics. You're 2 to 3 times more likely to develop IBS if it's part of your family history. Chase says, researchers in a 2021 study found 6 gene mutations that raise the risk of IBS. They also found that the same genetic makeup increases the risk for depression and anxiety. It makes sense, since we know IBS involves both your brain and your gut. What you can do. The first step is usually to make dietary changes, a low FODMAP diet, for instance. If that isn't enough, a laxative or antispasmodic may be prescribed. Tricyclic antidepressants such as nortriptyline, Palomar, and norepramin can help with abdominal pain and symptoms of diarrhea by slowing your GI tract. And finally, in this section, emotional trauma. A lot of research suggests that abuse or trauma early in life raises the risk to develop IBS later on, says Douglas Drossman, MD, founder and CEO of the Rome Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to education and research on disorders, including IBS. Drossman's research looked at the brain MRIs of abuse survivors with irritable bowel syndrome and found that the part of their brain that controls pain doesn't work as well as it does in people who have IBS alone. What you can do? Behavior interventions can help to manage symptoms, especially if you yours stems from stress or trauma, says Frank Celio, a psychologist in Ridgewood, New Jersey. These include cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. This is a type of talk therapy that works to change how you react to certain situations. Hypnosis. More than 30 published research studies show this treatment can help ease the symptoms of IBS. And lastly, Mahana IBS, a prescription-only digital CBT treatment that's been cleared by the Food and Drug Administration. Whatever the cause of your IBS, most people find relief through a combination of dietary changes, behavioral techniques, and sometimes medications. Now, we're going to move to a different bulletin, and this one is When Hackers Attacked Me, How I Survived an Onslaught on My Accounts by Cyber Thieves. This is under the heading of Fraud Watch. One day in late September, I woke up to an alarming text from my investment advisor saying he had replied to the email I had sent him. Problem was, I hadn't sent him an email. Muttering expletives, I hurriedly checked online and saw that someone had logged into my investment account and transferred out $4,000. I had been hacked and robbed. Up to then, I had felt safe from the scourging of phishing attacks and fraud, as I considered myself a savvy internet traveler. But it quickly became clear that cyber thieves were far more savvy than me. Within days, I was facing a full-on assault from online thieves. Even before the $4,000 was stolen, I noticed unusual activity in my accounts. I had received fraud alerts on 2 credit cards within minutes, both of which I canceled. Now, knowing the attack was real, I checked my online account at a large retail chain. 2 smartphones were in the shopping cart to be shipped to a sketchy mail drop point in Reisterstown, Maryland, a locale I had never visited. My digital wallet had a Bancorp bank credit card, which I hadn't ordered. Did hackers have all my passwords? Next, I discovered that my Amazon account had been locked due to a suspicious activity. I hadn't received any notifications from Amazon, so I called customer service. A smart representative advised me to check my email account and look at any filters that had been set up. As he suspected, hackers had blocked all emails from Amazon or my bank. This meant the hackers had not only my Amazon password, but my email password too. I suspected my computer might have malware, but 2 programs showed it was clean. My computer consultant mentioned that he had once been hacked through his router, which he told me was the most valuable part of, or the most vulnerable part of, a home network. So I changed the router password and the Wi-Fi password too. Next step was the time-consuming project of changing dozens of website passwords, one by one. When I opened my password manager and looked at the account data, I saw it had been accessed by 2 browsers that were not mine. Both were computers in Reisterstown. It was a gut-wrenching feeling to realize that even as I was changing passwords, hackers could see what I was doing. I logged out the 2 alien browsers and changed the password so they couldn't log back in. Getting Amazon to unlock my account was an ordeal. Customer service referred me to 2 different departments, neither of which can be reached by phone, and my emails drew automated replies. A public relations manager at Amazon offered to fast-track my problem, and even then, getting my account back to normal took weeks. The Amazon PR manager declined an interview but said via email, Amazon has systems in place to proactively protect customers and detect suspicious transactions. In the rare case where a customer had a bad experience, we go above and beyond to make things right. That may be true, but my experience suggests cyber thieves love the sight. My hackers even sent me a legit-looking email from Amazon customer service offering to help restore my account. It linked to a page that asked for my Social Security number. That's when I realized the hackers were cleverly posing as Amazon to gain even more information. It took dozens of hours and untold amounts of stress, but I was finally able to resolve all the hacking issues. Happily, my bank restored the $4,000. The main holdover from the hacking is a constant flood of phishing attempts. Within days, I was told I won 10 iPhones and a dozen Costco gift cards. Lucky me. The hacking attempts have stopped for now. I still check my phone every morning for fraud alerts. I've tightened up my online hygiene. I can't reverse the damage from the recent attack, but I hope to be better prepared the next time it happens. And it will. This article was by Rob Tannenbaum, who's a journalist who has written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Blender, GQ, and many other publications. And then the sidebar here is use what I learned to fight back. Turn on automatic software and app updates on your computers and phones so you always have the most current fraud-blocking tools. Use two-factor authentications, 2FA, for logins whenever you can. It requires you to enter a newly generated code sent to your phone before you can gain access to an account. Of course, you should have unique, elaborate passwords, but you should also use a password manager, such as 1Password, Bitwarden, LastPass, or Dashlane, to keep them protected and to sync the information on all of your devices. Freeze your credit at Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion to prevent someone from opening a credit card in your name. If you have an iPhone, turn on the Find My iPhone option, which enables activation, lock, and helps secure your Apple identity. And finally, create a dedicated email address you use only for financial services and not for work or personal email. Now, under the heading of your life, let's look at another one of the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement. Fred Gray on the Montgomery bus protest. 93 years old, living in Tuskegee, Alabama. A preacher and a civil rights attorney who argued some of the most important cases regarding race in American history. When I was growing up, there were two professions a black man could take up, a preacher or a teacher. I studied to become a preacher in Nashville, Tennessee, and when I returned to my home state of Alabama, I enrolled at the Alabama State College for Negroes, now Alabama State University. There were serious problems with how black people were treated on the buses, including one man who had been killed, E.D. Nixon, a black leader and president of the local NAACP branch, told me they needed lawyers and didn't know any. So, when I graduated college, I enrolled at Case Western Reserve, then Western Reserve, University Law School in Cleveland, Ohio. I passed the Alabama and Ohio bar exams in the summer of 1954. 6 months later, on March 2, 1955, a 15-year-old girl named Claudette Colvin was arrested for refusing to give up her seat on a public bus to a white person. Claudette lived in an area in the northern part of Montgomery. There were two or three streets of black families surrounded by whites. The black school kids had to take two buses to get to Booker T. Washington High School. On the day Claudette was arrested, the students had been let out early from school because of a teacher's meeting. When they got downtown, a lot of white people were getting on the bus, and they asked Claudette to get up from her seat. She was not sitting in what was called the white section, and so she told the bus driver she was not going to get up. She was arrested, and I agreed to represent her in juvenile court. Claudette's was my first civil rights case. The judge was very polite, but he still found her a delinquent. 9 months later, Rosa Parks did the same thing. I had known Mrs. Parks from the time I was an undergraduate at Alabama State. When I opened my law office in late September of 1954 to the day of her arrest on December 1, 1955, she would come to my office and talk about problems, about how even after the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision in 1954, no schools in Alabama were desegregated. We had talked about how a person should conduct themselves if they were asked to give up a seat on a bus. I had gotten the impression that if the opportunity presented itself, she would not give up her seat, which is what she did. She retained me to represent her. I met with Edgar Nixon of the NAACP and Joanne Robinson, an instructor at Alabama State University, who was the president of the Women's Political Council, an organization in Montgomery, to help blacks get registered to vote and to generally improve conditions. At her house, we planned the Montgomery bus boycott. Black people stopped riding buses, threatening to financially cripple the city's transportation system. Joanne Robinson said, "We will need a spokesman. My pastor, Martin Luther King, hasn't been here in Montgomery long, but he can move people with words. We can get him to be the spokesman." I had never met Dr. King. Few people knew who he was at that time. He was selected to be the spokesman, and I to do the legal work. We held a meeting at Holt Street Baptist Church. When the people heard Dr. King speak, we were convinced that important things were about to happen. And when the buses rolled on Monday morning, very few blacks were on them. Dr. King and I were in contact almost on a day-to-day basis for the 382 days of the bus boycott. Only we did not call it a boycott because it wasn't a boycott. We called it a protest. During that time, the word came to know his name. The world came to know his name. 3 months after the Montgomery bus protest began, Alabama indicted 89 persons. The prosecutors then decided that instead of trying 89 cases, they would select one, and of course, they selected Dr. King. I had the responsibility of getting a legal team together. We tried that case for 4 days. We were able to get black people to describe how they had been mistreated on the buses, including the wife of a man who had been killed. Notwithstanding, the judge found Dr. King guilty. For the rest of my life, I have fought to destroy everything segregated I could find. I have fought for education rights, for black voting rights, inequality, and the struggle for social justice continues. I am now 93 years old and am still fighting. A.J. Baim is the author of White Lies, The Double Life of Walter F. White, and America's Darkest Secrets. All right, how about looking at your life? There's no place like a home gym. Convert your kid's old bedroom or a corner of the basement into an exercise space you will actually use. It's into the new year, and you're ready to commit to getting back or staying in shape. One key to keeping that commitment? Convenience. The easier it is to get workouts done, the more likely you may be to keep doing them. And it doesn't get more convenient than a home gym. A recent poll by Civic Science reports that at-home exercises are 21% more likely than gym-goers to work out at least once a week. But converting a spare bedroom or basement space into an inviting home gym isn't as simple as setting up a treadmill and tossing a few dumbbells in the corner. The more beautiful and pleasant and engaging a space, the more apt you are to use it, says Stephen Weber, Associate Professor of Interior Architecture and Design at Florida State University. So we have a number of tips here. We won't get to all of them this time, but we will continue next time. Let's look at lighting. Artificial lighting can be harsh, uninviting, and unflattering. Consider lighting with modern technology that will let you adjust the tone among warm, white, and daylight settings. That will let you set the mood for your activity. Dimmers will give you more control, letting you recreate the ambiance and energy of a dim indoor cycling studio. For example, says Kelly Robinson, Assistant Professor of Interior Architecture and Design at Florida State. Advanced tech. Some high-tech video screens mount low on the wall and have exercise equipment built into them. They use digital resistance, so you can do exercise moves without actual weight, says New York City-based celebrity personal trainer Casey Duke. Weights and bands. Modern dumbbells will adjust from 5 to 50 pounds with the twist of a handle. Inexpensive resistance bands let you work every muscle. Storage. If you have a lot of loose equipment, such as dumbbells, medicine balls, kettlebells, mats, and bands, invest in a sports rack, shelves, or chest to keep it all organized and away from your areas of movement, Robinson says. The room layout. You can start by using painter's tape to mark where pieces will go. Depending on the size of the space, you can create workout stations. You can give your room flow and purpose by creating designated corners. You can have your yoga corner, strength corner, cardio corner, so forth. A bench. A bench reduces the need to get down on the floor. Duke says you can get them in great colors so the room is stylish. And floor space. Optimally, you should be able to do each of the four main types of exercise, strength training, cardio, balance exercises, and stretching, in the same room. That likely will require a 7 by 7 foot space with no equipment where you will do much of your movements. Now, in the little bit of time we have left, let's go back to your brain. 100 things you never knew. And we are up to number 18. Did you know that the brain burns 20% of the body's oxygen and glucose? Did you know that gray matter is thickest in girls at age 11 and in boys at age 12? Number 20, babies begin to laugh between 12 and 16 weeks. Number 21, your brain uses about 20 watts of power, approximately the same amount as a household light bulb. 22, only about 50 people in the world possess highly superior autobiographical memory. 23. At about 8 to 10 months, babies start to lose the ability to distinguish non-native language sounds. Number 24. Did you know, after hearing it twice, Mozart played a 2-minute choral composition from memory? Number 25. Did you know scientists have created false memories in mice? Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.